From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Today, I want to talk about writing, food writing, of course. I've always turned to stories as comfort, and in this uncertain moment in the pandemic, books and movies have provided both solace and escape. Consider the movie Pig, starring Nicolas Cage. The elevator pitch goes something like this. An acclaimed chef experiences trauma and walks away from the stove into the Oregon wilderness. He survives by hunting truffles with a companion pig who becomes a beloved partner. When the pig is taken, the wounded, solitary man must walk back into his Portland chef life to follow the trail of the theft. Michael Sarnowski and Vanessa Block are the duo behind the film, and they join me now to talk about what it takes to bring authenticity to restaurant and food culture in a script. Welcome, the two of you. It's wonderful to have you here. I so loved the movie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What was the initial image the two of you came up with that would eventually grow into the screenplay, the movie, Pig?
So initially, I read an article. I think it was an article. I'm honestly not exactly sure where it was, but it mentioned how truffle hunters will sit out on their porches at night with a shotgun to protect their truffle pigs and dogs from being stolen because they can be so valuable if they're good at what they do. That other people will want them. And I just found that image extremely striking, and that idea that these animals would be, you know, worth killing for to protect. And then that kind of coupled with just this image of this old man in the woods with his pig hunting for truffles and sort of asking those questions of where did he come from? Why is he in the woods? Why is he using a pig to hunt for truffles? Which is also kind of an old-fashioned way of doing it. Nowadays, people use dogs mostly. So those were kind of the images that started the juices going on getting this story.
Robin's character, played by Nicolas Cage, is just extraordinary because it's exactly the opposite of what we've come to expect from Cage. There's so much restraint and quietude in his character, and we're really left to sit with his silence a lot of the time. Did he do anything special to prepare for the role? Like, did he take cooking lessons or did he spend time with any professional chefs?
Yeah, Michael and I made a number of trips up to Portland prior to the shooting of the film. And in those trips, we met with a number of chefs, one of whom was Chris Czarnecki, who is the son of a very prolific and renowned truffle hunter named Jack Czarnecki. They own a truffle oil company, and they were kind enough to take us on an actual kind of mock truffle hunt, introduce us to their dogs that sniff out the truffles, show us that process. And Chef Czarnecki ended up being the main food consultant on the film. So we set Nick up with him to do a series of tutorials just because, you know, Rob as a character is this like former superstar chef, and we wanted to make sure that Nick had the physicality down. We wanted to get the sense that there was this, you know, almost sensual relationship that he had with food, which Nick as a man also does have that relationship to food. He's a big foodie and has a lot of respect and reverence for the art of cooking. So it was also something very kind of natural within him, but we gave him the structure of having these chef lessons with Mr. Czarnecki to help kind of bring that to the surface more.
Yeah, Nick was up. So he had cooking lessons with Chef Czarnecki and Chef Gabe Rucker, also from Portland, because it was very important that we wanted the dishes cooked in the film to be actual dishes that are served in Portland restaurants.
Let's talk about some of the food in the film, starting with the rustic mushroom tart.
So the rustic mushroom tart is the first dish that Nick prepares in the film. And that's actually based on the Czarnecki family's old family recipe for, I think in their cookbook, it's called the Three Mushroom Tart. And we actually made that during a script reading at one point. And it's delicious. They served it to us at their restaurant. And that's that first moment where we see Nick interacting with food. And it's also the first moment that music comes into the film. And it's played as like this very intimate, almost spiritual moment for him. And without giving away too many spoilers about the film, I think in the moment, it's this bonding thing between him and the pig. And it's kind of lonely, but also very sweet and sentimental. And then later on, it takes on a little more meaning as far as what his backstory is and what that means to him and how he shares that with other people. And it's also just an extremely good tart.
It's a moment that I think is surprising for people because you have this grizzled man, you know, living out in the wilderness, and then there's this incredible care, sensuality, almost poetry with which he cooks this dish as if he's, you know, doing a cooking show. So, you know, it's kind of that first glimpse, as Michael said, into the past of this man. And I think a little bit of a wink to the audience that says not everything that you see of him is what it, you know, what it actually is.
So in the process of looking for his stolen truffle pig, we're taken on a journey of the Portland food scene and at one point into a fine dining restaurant. It's the hottest restaurant in town, and it turns out that the chef is one of Robin's former cooks. Let's listen to a clip.
What is the concept here?
We're interested in taking local ingredients native to this region and just deconstructing them, you know, making the familiar feel foreign, thereby giving us an even greater appreciation of food as a whole.
This is the kind of cooking you like?
It's cutting edge. It's very exciting.
Exciting.
I mean, everybody loves it.
You like cooking it?
Absolutely.
What were you trying to say in this particular moment in the film?
You know, I think we've turned authenticity into a product in some ways. And so we try to market things as like, oh, how close to truth they are. But sometimes we get confused whether we're, you know, actually finding authenticity or we're finding the product of authenticity that has been kind of crafted with the intention of feeling authentic. So, you know, I mean, I think that feeling is true in a lot of art forms and certainly in cooking. And, you know, we were poking fun at that a little bit.
Yeah, I thought the scene was incredibly powerful because we basically are him as we sit there and experience, as you say, what the commodification of the relationship to nature as it's expressed in this type of cooking can become. And you really have to sit with that. So I apologize in advance for this next question, but I really just have to ask it. What about the decision to keep Cage's character unwashed? Is the layers of dirt a metaphor?
I think it does a few things, and I definitely know that that's a point that people take issue with in the film. This film is about how Rob connects with himself and with other people. And initially, at the beginning of the film, he barely really sees other people as real, and he kind of barely sees his own identity as real. Like, he's kind of allowed himself to dissolve a little bit. So I think the not washing the face is both, it shows how single-minded he is about this pig, how it's just, you know, he's not going to do anything for himself until he figures out what happened to his pig. And then it also shows that he almost has gotten to the point where he doesn't register how other people see him, and he almost doesn't see himself anymore. So it almost just doesn't compute for him. There's also a funny story about it, because I remember some people, some producers and different people had said, really, we're going to keep him bloody the entire time? I mean, people would mention something about that, which I assumed that was true. It was meant to be a little heightened that oftentimes people just ignore it. But we did makeup tests with Nick in his hotel room, and we were testing out how bloody we wanted to make him and how quickly we could do it. And after that, we all went down and had lunch at the hotel restaurant, and he decided to stay fully in bloody makeup. And it was really gruesome and quite realistic looking. And it was funny because not a single person mentioned it in the hotel. Like, no one, I mean, obviously they were maybe afraid to say something, or they assumed he was Nick in a movie, but no one even drew attention to it.
Also, the tagline for Portland is "Keep Portland Weird." So, you know, Portland is a really colorful, textured place, and I think you see all sorts of things there. So, something that might, you know, sort of stand out in a different environment in Portland is kind of, you know, pretty standard.
Thank you both so much. It really is a surprising and wonderful film.
Thank you so much.
That's writer-director Michael Sarnowski and co-creator-producer Vanessa Block. Their film Pig is in theaters and available on demand. From the screen to the page, we talk with a writer and a cook about bringing the food of fantasy to life. That's next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. You decide to write a science fiction novel, so you have to build a world. What part would food play for you in creating that world? If you're a frequent listener of this show, my guess is the big one. UK writer Ellie Lee examined the world of Ursula Le Guin's Always Coming Home in an article for UK-based newsletter Victuals. She also was confronted with these same questions when she embarked on her own book, A Strange and Brilliant Light. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us from so far away. Let's start with this idea of world building. What is it? How does it differ in a science fiction novel than in just regular fiction?
That's a really good question. And I think the main difference between sci-fi and fantasy as well, and then regular fiction, is that in quite a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, the world is utterly imaginary. And so it might be based on a real world. Like, for example, Game of Thrones is such a sort of obvious one. But you need to fill in those details. The writer fills in and fleshes out the details of that world themselves. And so that can be very big things like the kind of people there are, the religions. And then it's also smaller things like what they wear, what they eat, what they do on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, that very detailed fleshing out is how you create a very different world to reality that readers can step into.
Is the imaginary that the writer is creating, is it fully created or does it need to have roots in the real?
I think in every case, it does have to have its roots in the real. I think it would be almost impossible to create something imaginary without its roots in the real. So I'll give you an example of that. A really good one is in Ursula Le Guin's, she wrote this enormous novel in the mid-1980s called Always Coming Home. And in Always Coming Home, the names of the dishes are imaginary because she's created a whole world with a different culture, a different people. But it's set in a place that's based on Northern California, where she grew up. And so the dishes are also based in reality. They're actually based on what you could grow in your garden or in the fields or the valleys beyond. So they've got imaginary names and they're unfamiliar to us, but they are based in the real.
She's a really fascinating example. Her people in that book, the Kesh, the recipes she includes of theirs, and in that book, she does in fact include recipes, they seem like they would be totally at home in our world. So what makes them otherworldly? Our imagination?
So the recipes in Always Coming Home, because they've got unfamiliar names, like there's one called Hotoku, which means old hen, and there's one called Lirif Metadi, but they all are familiar recipes. So because the world of Always Coming Home is both familiar and otherworldly, and the recipes, what they do is they feed into that. They feed into both the familiarity and the otherworldliness. And so the otherworldliness in the whole book is created by the world building, which includes the food, but it's also the people are unfamiliar. Le Guin says it's set in a distant future, in a very long time away from now. The Kesh, they live in small communities. Their housing is different to anything we have today. They are noticeably not of our time. She calls the book My Utopia. It's her eco-utopia. The whole thing is a fiction. It's a dream. But within that fiction, within the dream, it's all kind of real as well, because Le Guin's fictional dream was real. It sounds like a paradox, but it actually, the reality of it is what makes it a full and understandable vision. And that's the same with the food in it as well. The food is both imaginary and it's also familiar and real. But because you're eating that food, in that unfamiliar world, you're sitting by the fire, you know, with the Kesh, these strange people who you don't know and you will never know. You have this experience at the same time of total strangeness and also total familiarity. And I think that's what makes it work.
Let's talk for a minute about your own writing and your book, A Strange and Brilliant Light. I'm wondering if you could read the passage where you describe the dinner that she arranged on her desk back in Daunt.
Back in Daunt, she arranged dinner on her desk. Octopi skewers, moye balls and crispy sander fritters from small white bags leaking with grease. And for dessert, a dense, squidgy Dulac cake bought from street vendors downtown. Although it was late by the time she got back to her room, the promise of the food laid out before her made her feel truly happy for the first time that day. She speared a moye ball, which leaked up mayonnaise and thick golden oil as she lifted it up. These were the kind of snacks you could get everywhere. In Alrusa, she'd buy them at convenience stores, then heat them up at home, or she'd have them at her friend Rose's. Rose's mum was an excellent, prolific cook, and her moye balls were always more succulent and less greasy than the shop ones. With one hand, she'd brown the batter as she folded it into balls, while with the other, she'd fry the sander into flat, lacy fritters. Lal and Rose would devour them straight from the pan while they were still piping hot. Neither of Lal's own parents had such skills, but Rose, who'd been taught by her mum, had shown her a couple of times how to make them. Lal never bothered herself, though. After all, she was at Rose's, getting fed like that every day.
So how do these foods of Yalran cuisine explore the space between the real and the imaginary for you? And do you use your own personal food history to create these items?
Yes, I use my personal food history. I think it turned out to be inevitable. Much like Le Guin, I'm pretty sure Le Guin used her own personal history of growing up in California before she moved to Oregon to create the world of the Kesh and Always Coming Home because she spent her summers in the Napa Valley. I delved into my past when I was creating the imaginary food of my imaginary world. So, for example, the Dulac cake that I just mentioned. Who knows what Dulac cake is? It just appeared in my imagination, but I knew that it would taste something like the honey that my mum is a beekeeper. She's been a beekeeper in London for 30 years now. I knew it would taste something like some of the honey, the London honey that she gets from her bees. So the nectar is from, it's from lime tree blossoms and it's from white clover. It's from blackberry flowers. And that was somewhere near the region of what I imagine the Dulac cake might taste like. But it's also, I'm not imposing that on the reader. I think the thing about imaginary food is that whilst I might have an idea of what it can taste like, it opens up the reader's imagination too, and it lets them attach their own food associations to a piece of cake that they read about. It lets them attach their own emotions to it as well.
It's been lovely talking to you, Ellie. Thank you so much.
That's all right. Thank you so much. It was a really wonderful conversation.
That's Ellie Lee. We've been talking about creating the imaginary food of fictional worlds. Her debut novel, A Strange and Brilliant Light, looks into the future. As a child, reading brought me to food nearly as much as eating it. And I don't mean that I read cookbooks for children. No, I absorbed fiction like water, and in nearly every story there was food. But how do you make a recipe that will work in the real world of something you read about in a fictional, magical, or a fantastical one? Leslie Bilderbach is here to tell us how. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Evan.
It's great to have you.
It's great to talk to you again.
These particular stories that you've focused on go from Shakespeare to Tolkien, Star Wars and Witch's Brews, Dungeons and Dragons, World of Warcraft. Magical nannies has to be one of my favorite categories. What is it about the descriptions of food in these particular stories that draw us in and made you want to write this particular book?
Well, first of all, I just love fiction in general, but I really wanted to relate these magical elements of these stories, because in the stories, when there's magic, when there's witchcraft, we can't really relate to that because that's not real. But when they bring food into it, we can relate to that food because we all eat and we can really understand the process of eating or cooking or whatever's happening in the story. So it is a sort of a link for us into these fantastical worlds. And then in the really fantastic realms, when the ingredients are weird, that's even more delightful to imagine.
As a child, when I read Wind in the Willows for the first time, I think that Ratty's Picnic was something that really, really captivated me and let me understand that the world of food was kind of open and endless. Do you remember what non-cookbook culinary scenes hit you hard as a child?
First of all, Ratty's Picnic always befuddled me because I didn't understand what potted meat was. I imagined that you planted meat like a flower and a meat tree grew.
I love that.
But yes. For me, I think it was the Little House books. I wanted to be a pioneer child. From the very first book, Little House in the Big Woods, they're boiling maple syrup and pouring it on snow to make candy. And there's really vivid scenes about the long winter when they didn't have any grain and they took the seed grain and they ground it in the coffee mill to make bread to survive, and Johnny Cakes and all, learning how to churn butter, all that stuff really captivated me. I'm a little disappointed that I am not a pioneer, but I loved it.
You were a pioneer in your own way.
Thank you.
So let's talk about some of these recipes. Start us off with something from the Tolkien universe.
The Tolkien universe is a terrific food journey because, you know, while all of those stories are sort of medieval in tone and the settings are very medieval and the way they dress is very medieval, but Tolkien was pretty, he was a smart cookie because he couldn't really do medieval food. You wouldn't really relate to eating, you know, a stuffed swan or whatever. So he used food that he knew, that he grew up with in Warwickshire and, you know, around the 1890s. And so it's very relatable, especially to his audience, which was originally kids, I think. So I've used a lot of the really iconic food scenes to draw from. Like in the very first book, in The Hobbit, the very beginning, there's the unexpected party where Bilbo Baggins thinks he's going to get have tea with Gandalf the Wizard, and 13 dwarves show up and they eat him out of house and home. And it's so vividly written. And you really get a sense of not only how proud he is of his home, but what a really good cook Bilbo was and what a great host he was. So that's the kind of thing to me that is just so fun. And I know there's millions of Tolkien fans out there that are familiar with every one of these food references, you know, which is also kind of the fun part about it, is you sort of dive into the fans.
Have they found you yet?
Yeah, they did, actually. I'm doing a live demo for Oxenmoot, which is the Tolkien convention in Oxford. I'm not going to Oxford, but I'll be streaming to Oxford for them. So that'll be fun.
I think your journey from now on is going to be extremely interesting because of this book.
I hope so.
So let's talk about magical nannies. You know, they play so many different roles in these magical stories and movies. That like they can be hapless, they could be mean, they mm-hmm. can be saviors. But the nature of their role means that they're always feeding children. So yeah. I would love it if you would share one of the recipes that you came up with and talk about that particular nanny.
The one that I love is Bedknobs and Broomsticks. The character, Miss Price, she becomes a nanny by default. She doesn't set out to be a nanny, but she ends up having to nanny three kids. And it's because it takes place during World War II when all the kids were evacuated from London and they had to go live with strangers in the countryside. And that's what these kids do with Miss Price. But she's actually taking this correspondence course to learn to be a witch, and she doesn't really have time for kids. It's wacky because she tries to feed them things like nettles, things that they eat in the country, but they just want like regular London food. So I just did toad in the hole for that one, but I did little individual ones with Yorkshire pudding, which is a pretty traditional take on that. But that's the hapless nanny right there.
So I have to say, I don't think I've ever seen a recipe before for Yorkshire pudding that has a sausage baked into it. It just looks gorgeous.
It's pretty good. We usually do Yorkshire pudding at Christmas, but after we did this, now we stick a sausage in it too.
We have to talk about the Potterverse, and I want you to talk about the treacle tart, because there are one or two people who are not besotted with the Great British Bake Off and may not understand what treacle is. This was Harry's favorite dessert, right?
Yes, it's also Mary Berry's favorite dessert, treacle tart. Yeah, treacle is like a byproduct of the sugar process. There's golden syrup, which is a light treacle. And then there's dark treacle, which is like blackstrap molasses. So it's basically a more refined version of molasses, in my opinion. People spread it on toast like honey, right? The golden syrup version. And then treacle tart is a really old standard. And it reminds me sort of Brown Betty in that it uses bread, not any other kind of pastry topping. You know, it's really, really simple ingredients.
Now I want you to just tell us one of the recipes that fans have latched onto and seems that it's going to be like one of the most popular from the book, or something you just love and you want to tell us the story.
It's not out. It keeps getting pushed and pushed and pushed.
Oh, yeah. Tell us. I understand that you had some censorship issues with China.
Right. So it was pushed back a few months, and then it was pushed a year. And then it was meant to come out this month. And the printer was in China. And in the little, there's a Disney chapter. And in the Little Mermaid recipe, I tell a story about how the Little Mermaid was the last, or at least for a long time, the last hand-painted animation cells. And there's millions and millions of bubbles in that movie. And so they outsourced bubbles to a Chinese animation firm. And all of this was taking place right around the student protest in Tiananmen Square. And so I mentioned that. And just because I said the word student protest Tiananmen Square, China flagged it and wouldn't print it. And happily, my publisher said, well, we'll just find another printer then. She didn't want to take it out. So I thought that was nice and made me happy, but it pushed it another couple months. Supposedly October, first week in October is when it's slated now. And we have actual copies in our hands, right? So we know that it has been printed somewhere.
And it's gorgeous.
Thank you.
Leslie, it's been a pleasure, and it really is a marvelous book.
Oh, thank you so much. I so appreciate it. And it's great to talk to you again.
That is Leslie Bilderbach, and her book is Once Upon a Kitchen. It truly is a magical book. In a minute, food writing in the real world. What does it mean to be a food writer in 2021? We introduce you to a beat writer who's carved out a very special niche when Good Food returns. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Some of the most compelling food writing in 2021 comes in the form of newsletters. Yes, I still read my local food section every week. Newspapers are invaluable for local journalism. But newsletters allow you to get, well, niche. Take Unsnackable, the weekly newsletter by Folu Akinkwotu. She describes it as a girl trying to cope with a deeply ingrained there's rice at home mindset by dreaming about inaccessible snacks and cooking complicated food in a tiny kitchen. An accomplished home cook, Folu uses her newsletter to occasionally share recipes, but mostly it's about the fantasy of tasting faraway snacks that most of us will never, ever eat. Hi, Folu.
Hi.
You straddle two food media worlds, the humble brag diet, where you're making things that seem simple. You're making things that seem simple, but actually require cooking chops to do. And then there's Unsnackable, where you review snacks that you may or may not have actually tasted. Is there a Venn diagram where they intersect?
Yeah, I think my biggest goal with Unsnackable is that I always felt pretty comfortable with cooking. Over quarantine, I think I got better with food photography just because I was sitting in my apartment and learned how to cut down on enough variables that I was like, all right, here's how to tweak the things to make things, to make your pictures have, you know, a style, to kind of have them turn out in a similar way. But I think my big goal with Unsnackable was to get more comfortable with writing about food. Writing about food that you cook is such an emotional thing. And I think being self-taught, that can feel like such a big thing to conquer. And I think that we are in such an interesting time in food blogging and food Instagramming, and people are doing a lot of things that are very heartfelt and interesting, but there's also a lot of practices that are ruled by SEO and monetization. So finding your voice within that can be a little hard. So I turn to snacks to kind of give myself like a walled garden, a way to explore something that I was figuring out how to do without it being too intimidating.
So let's talk about snacks. Your parents owned vending machines. Is that where your interest in snacks first started?
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it early on. But I think I've also always loved snacks in general. I think that was what helped me to think a bit more about snacks overall and not just what I wanted to eat. So when we would go to a wholesale club, Sam's Club or Costco, wherever we ended up going, I would help to pick out the things that we would put into the vending machines for that short time that we had the vending machines. It wasn't too long, but it was something that I really enjoyed doing with my parents and really enjoyed the time of just going there and stocking the machines and occasionally stealing a few of the snacks that didn't sell and taking them to school as my snack.
It seems like we're living in a golden age of snacks that is predicated on global shipping and internet shopping. Have you actually eaten every snack you write about, or are there some snacks that you see and you read about, but you don't actually get to taste them?
A majority of the snacks in the newsletter are actually things that I have never tried. That was really the big part of why I started it during quarantine last fall. It was hard to go out and shop for different snacks or, you know, just to wander into international markets. I live in Boston, and actual Boston and the area surrounding it have just so many different communities, and there's so many small markets that I could walk into and find, you know, Italian snacks, Polish snacks, African snacks, snacks from the Caribbean. And because I wasn't really taking the train, I wasn't even really spending a lot of time in the actual grocery store. I would just go in, go out, have my list, and try to work through everything as quickly as possible. I just miss the act of browsing. So I started to look online and see some of the other snacks that I thought were interesting.
So, you know, on this show, we're talking about food writing, but we're also talking about fictional food and how to create fictional food in a novel, and conversely, how to create an actual recipe from something that's a fantasy. And what fascinates me about what you're doing is that, in a way, they're fictional for you, even though they actually exist. What is it like to finally taste one that you've thought so much about? Is it ever deeply disappointing?
Yeah, sometimes it can be disappointing, but one of the parameters I try to give myself is to remember that they are snack foods, and I try not to buy the most expensive versions of them. There's this new and upcoming online market segment of people who are selling on Instagram and who are selling on these little exotic snack shops. And you can see a soda that if you bought it in its country of origin would be, you know, a dollar to an American currency converted, but they'll be selling it for $15 or $16 plus shipping.
Wow.
And I think about that, like, I don't want to pay that much for it. Like, I'll pay, you know, $2, $3, $4 for something and, you know, get a bunch of different things so I don't have to pay too crazy of shipping prices. But spending $15 plus, you know, $10 of shipping for a soda makes it very easy to get disappointed. Also because, you know, global shipping isn't always efficient. Things can be stale or melted. It's a big gamble.
So describe a savory snack that you've eaten recently that you love and would like people to share your love.
One of my favorite savory snacks are the Calbee Grillicorn. I guess they're technically chips, but what they are is if you took the texture of Cheetos and then you didn't make them cheese coated, they're actually covered with like a salty mala pepper spice. And it's kind of just generally nice to eat them. But as you continue to eat them, the heat builds and it's just a very enjoyable experience to eat them.
Can you describe Black Thunder fermented butter?
Yeah.
Because the name.
Yeah, it's a great name. And they're really delicious. I think if you were to find a rough approximation of what they're like, it's a little bit like a Crunch bar, but much, much better because it has ground up cookies in it, as well as the puffed corn. And the puffed corn is a little bit crunchier than they are just the puffed rice in a Crunch bar in the US. And those textures together, you kind of get like a little bit of sandiness from the cookies, and then you get just the different size pieces of cookies and the crunch from the puffed corn all together in a chocolate that has a lot of flavor, but isn't so overwhelming that it makes it hard to consume. And it's also often portioned into a smaller single size candy bar. So you can enjoy the whole thing without getting overwhelmed or having to wrap up part of it and finish it later or have two.
And it's made with French cultured butter.
Yeah, in the cookies. So it's like a shortbread style cookie. And I think it's a very cool nod to the way that so much of Japan's bakery culture is based on French technique that they've made into their own entirely unique bakery culture. And they've brought it in so many ways. There's actually lots of snacks that are cultured butter flavored. And given how high quality the dairy is in so many parts of Japan, even though they're mass market snacks, it really ends up being pretty exceptional.
This has been so fascinating. I want to thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Folo Akinkotu. She's a snack maven. Subscribe to her newsletter at unsnackable.com and join her in eating around the world one handful at a time. The story of the first Black-owned brewery in Inglewood, Crowns and Hops, is next when Good Food returns. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Most entrepreneurs will tell you they don't want to be like anybody else in the market. But Benny Ashburn and Tio Hunter are hoping to start a revolution. They're the owners of Crowns and Hops, one of the few Black-owned breweries in the country, and they're planning to build an empire of liquid gold. This summer, they launched an equity crowdfunding campaign to build their very own facility in Inglewood. Benny and Tio join us for this week's In the Weeds.
Hi, my name is Benny Ashburn. I am the CEO of Crowns and Hops Brewing Company.
I'm Tio Hunter, the COO and head of brewing operations for Crowns and Hops Brewing Company.
When we first started in the craft beer industry, maybe about 6-7 years ago, our focus was primarily to introduce and showcase what Black and Brown culture looked like in craft beer. Tio introduced me to the craft beer community, and he was very amazing in educating me on the complexity and the styles of craft beer. The other part of craft beer that I also think people aren't as familiar with is the culture. And the culture is very family friendly, is very welcoming. So as we started to visit many of these breweries and notice that there were no people of color, we took it upon ourselves to start to create those spaces for communities of color. So through content and curated experiences in locations where we knew we could galvanize our community, be it barbershops or clothing stores or sneaker shops, we started to introduce craft beer to the market in a way that was just not done before.
Our first beer that we ever released was literally based off of an acronym of our first Instagram handle, which was Black People Love Beer or Brown People Love Beer. So we literally called the beer BPLB. And based off of our experience of tasting, doing tastings all over the country, even overseas as well, we realized that the hazy IPA, also known as the Northeast style IPA, one of the newest styles in craft beer, it's only about a decade old, would be that first transformative beer that we could give the community because of it not being overly bitter, of it having notes of tropical fruits and guava and pineapple and stone fruit. And it was still an IPA that you didn't need to add fruit. So with that beer, it just not only became something that was well-respected in the existing craft beer community, but also became something that was very attractive to those who had never even tasted craft beer before. My journey started really early in craft beer. I'd say probably going on about 15 years ago. You know, I was just coming out of the military and had a job in the entertainment industry, primarily in print and production. And I just noticed so many of my clients and so many of the people in the creative industry came from craft beer centric areas, whether it be San Diego, Portland, Denver, on the East Coast. And it just blew me away that I didn't know about craft beer. No one had introduced it to me. No one had ever given it to me. The circles that I were personally involved in didn't celebrate craft beer. And it was only until I would go out to bars and restaurants and have a beverage with some of these new clients and new friends that I would be made aware of these beers with strange names, with spellings that I couldn't really pronounce, with artwork that just really, I think, resonated with me because of what I was doing in entertainment. So naturally, I was curious about it. But even more importantly, it was delicious. So I think being bit by all of those particular types of bugs, it caused me to really do a deep dive into it, to later understand that the industry itself had an issue with being diverse, with being inclusive.
In the hardships of COVID, through just the COVID itself and of the George Floyd murder, there are a lot of opportunity actually presented itself for the Black community in terms of entrepreneurship. And the mission that myself and Tio have been focused on in Crowns and Hops, getting rid of this, you know, lack of diversity, creating more racial equity inside of an industry, I think people then started to really hear what we were saying. You know, having lived in this world for 7 years, I think finally everything that we had been pushing for, all of the initiatives that we created, were now received in a very different way. They were received with a lot more understanding, you know, a lot of eyes wide open. And I think because of that opportunity, when we did finally release our products on shelves last year, we were able to get in a lot of retail stores, and we were able to get a lot of attention. One, because the product itself is very good, you know, thanks to Tio. But secondly, because we were a brand that was very focused on change.
You know, Crowns is plural for a reason, because the people deserve crowns. You know, the people deserve the most premium things in their communities and not outside of their communities. To have a brick and mortar, the first Black-owned brewing company in Inglewood, California, we need the investment of the community, not just the community of Inglewood, the community, the craft beer community, who understands the significance of what we're doing, because this is bigger than beer. This is about ownership. This is about racial equity. And in light of that, we just launched an equity crowdfunding campaign that, in our opinion, is the truest form of being a community-based business. Also, it's so important for us to be in Inglewood, California. It's a city that I was born in. I was born in Sentinella Hospital, probably a stone's throw from where our brewery, brew pub, restaurant will be. And it's so important for us to bring progressive concepts and ideas to a city that has only been known, or rather that has only been shown to produce a certain type of business. We're not monolithic. We're so much more than that. And I think being able to bring this space to Inglewood would be in line with driving legacy, building legacy in a community that is already rich with diversity and culture.
We would love to suggest something for the listeners to drink. We just recently released a beer called the Blue Peach. It is a blueberry peach goes. It was brewed in collaboration with Barrel and Flow Festival, one of the only Black beer festivals in the country, as well as with Black Calder. They are the first Black-owned brewery out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. This beer is specifically has a beautiful illustration of Stacey Abrams on the cover, hence the name Blue Peach.
It's a really special beer. We brewed it with peaches, blueberries, coriander, cinnamon, vanilla, graham cracker dust, and black lava sea salt. And the last recommendation would probably be our flagship beer, which we mentioned earlier, which is BPLB. That's our hazy IPA. It's our flagship hazy IPA. And we truly think it's indicative of everything that we're hoping to do in the community in terms of craft beer, and also what we're hoping to do in the community, the Black community and the Brown community, as far as representation as well.
Benny Ashburn and Tio Hunter are the owners of Crowns and Hops. Check out their website, crownsandhops.com, to find out who is stocking their beer in your neighborhood. And finally, we head to the market, where summer is turning into fall. Jillian Ferguson is there now with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the market report. Rosh Hashanah is a week from Monday, and the apples have arrived at Southern California markets just in time. I'm in Santa Monica today with Megan Tucker, who's the chef and owner behind the vegan Jewish deli, Mort and Betty's, and she's here to share some sweet ideas for the Jewish New Year. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to see you. So apples, of course, are a must on the Rosh Hashanah table. Can you talk a little bit about their symbolism and just how you like to incorporate them into your Jewish New Year table?
Definitely. So they are a sweet fruit, and Rosh Hashanah is all about bringing in sweetness into the new year. They are sort of all over the place in the menu, starting with the baked goods. We have an apple stuffed challah bread that will be baked in a round shape also for the new year. We're doing a pumpkin apple babka, which I'm super excited about. We're using kabocha squash in addition to the apple to get that pumpkin into the recipe. And then I'm also doing a traditional Jewish apple cake. And then into the savory side of the menu, one of the dishes that incorporates apples is the vegetable side dish, which is a roasted Brussels sprout and braised cabbage dish, which is going to have a apple agrodolce, which is sort of a sweet and sour. The sour really complements the braised cabbage, and then the sweet as well just really rounds out the dish, and it's finished with pomegranate and dill. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. So what's the sour component in the agrodolce?
So apple cider vinegar and then apple juice are reduced down to make a syrup. And typically an agrodolce might be made with balsamic. And so typically it's sort of a dark balsamic color, but this one is a little bit lighter. It is super tasty and not too sour, because it is about bringing sweetness into the new year.
Sure. And I'm particularly curious about your apple cake, because you're, of course, a vegan deli. So that means that this cake has no eggs in it. Can you walk us through the recipe and specifically talk about what you use as an egg replacement?
I use a lot of different things to replace eggs. I don't like relying on any of the commercially available, egg replacers that you can just buy off the shelf. For this recipe, because it's a cake, flaxseed meal works really well. And my big tip for working with flax seeds is to grind them yourself. Often when you buy them pre-ground at the store, it's not really fine enough, and you sort of detect this texture that doesn't belong in the baked goods. And so I really recommend grinding them yourself, like in a coffee grinder. And then there's also a little bit of turmeric for color. And then kala namak, which is the Himalayan black salt. And that has like a sulfury kind of eggy flavor. And so I don't use a lot of it. A little goes a long way. But those three components are what I use in this recipe to replace eggs.
And what about the apples that you're choosing? Are you looking for a specific baking apple?
So I like to do a mixture of apples in anything that I'm baking. And so in the cake, I want to have some apples that are more firm in the finished cake, and then some that will be softer. And actually, this cake also has some apple sauce in it for more flavor. And so those apples are all the varieties that will cook down and really be, easy to make into a apple sauce.
Sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Megan Tucker, chef owner of Mort and Betty's, a vegan Jewish deli. You can find her every Sunday at Smorgasburg. And she's also accepting pre-orders for her Rosh Hashanah menu until this Monday. Details are on her website, mortandbettys.com. And if you want to try making that apple cake yourself, she actually has a video tutorial linked on the Mort and Betty's Instagram. Farmer Mike Cerrone, famous for his Blenheim apricots, is equally known for the dizzying array of apples he brings to the market in late summer and early fall. Mike, you are just now kicking off your season. Can you just remind us how many varieties you bring throughout the season?
We'll bring 60 varieties.
60. Okay, so I've been shopping with you for over a decade, and I still get overwhelmed by coming to the table. What's the best approach for someone who is curious to try a new variety but doesn't really know where to start?
Well, what we do is we line the table up from sweet to tart. If you need to have sweet apples, they're all down on one end, and then they gradually get more tart as the table progresses. Today, I think we had 13 varieties, which seems like a lot for August, but our orchards are set up for early season, mid-season, and late.
So of the varieties of the early season that are on the table now, can you pick one sweet and one tart and tell us a little bit about them?
Okay, so one of the best early season sweet apples, actually it's one of the best in general, but it's only available like right now. It's a little window. It's called Molly Delicious. So it's not a delicious like Red Delicious or Golden, it's Molly. And it's very light colored apple. It's kind of striped, and it's really crispy and fresh and sweet. Not like Fuji sweet, but just kind of like this subtle sweetness, very nice. I've been using them on my oatmeal in the morning. They're lovely. So that would be the one I would recommend. And then in the tart department, boy, we grow a lot of really great tart apples. Today we had some Jonathan's that are super primo. I had some very select pick Empire, which is an awesome apple. And then I have this other variety that's called Golden Supreme. It's sublime. I'm always bummed when that one's gone. Because what happens is people start buying it, and then they want it, and they want it, and they want it. But they're only here now, and they're slightly green. They start to turn a little yellow when they're at their most primo state. And then poof, they're gone. And so those would be my favorites at the moment. But it switches really quick. You know, Sea Canyon is just such a good place for apples. And for the most part, they're dry farmed. And this year, because it's been so dry, they seem to really have picked up their characteristics.
And what do we have to look forward to that's coming up for mid and late season?
Well, a lot of stuff's coming up. We have Braeburn, really good dry farm Braeburns that are just full of flavor. We have Mutsu. Oh, my goodness. That is such a good apple.
That's a lot of people's favorite.
Yeah, it's catching on. And I've been planting more Mutsu. Jonna Gold. We have these really good original Jonna Golds, meaning when Jonna Gold first came out, we planted them. Now, what's happened with Jonna Gold, which happens with a lot of apple varieties, they begin to breed them for better color. But when they start doing that, they're just not the same. Their skin gets thicker or something happens. But these original Jonna Golds, they're super juicy. I mean, they're crazy. They're really good.
Thank you so much, Mike.
You're welcome.
That was Mike Cerrone of Sea Canyon. He brings down as many as 60 varieties of apples throughout the season. You can find him at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and Paul Smith. And to Nisha Venkat for production assistance. I'm Evan Kleiman. Next week is Labor Day. I hope your holiday is full of relaxation and light on the labor. Be well, everyone. I'll meet you back here next week for a rice-themed episode of Good Food.